Excuse me, I'll be brief. But I, you know, it's interesting so far. There's an interesting theme, I think. I heard a lot about from Judge Brown communication, a lot about from Judge Frank familiarity, and how these things seem to bring a benefit. I mean, it's amazing how many people and groups I notice are against things that they don't know, are not familiar with, have never communicated with, or simply don't understand. You know, I live a few miles, I guess about 45 minutes, 50 minutes south of New York City in a suburb. It's amazing to me. I mean, we have New York City, the center of the universe, 45 minutes away. It's amazing to me how many people are afraid, my friends, people I know, will not go to New York City. Because of what they, I don't know, maybe what they heard about New York City in 1977 or something. I'm not sure. But there is an awful lot of that cloistering going on out there. And these are not my remarks. I'm sorry. I'm just compelled to by what I've just heard. Let me just tell you who I am. I am an EEOC administrative judge. If you don't work for the federal government, then you'll never really have contact with an EEOC administrative judge. We are the judges for, I guess, somewhere between 2 and 3 million federal employees when those federal employees bring a discrimination claim against their employer, whatever federal agency they might work with. I guess strike that. There is a possibility if you're not a federal government employee and you apply for a job with the federal government, you then might come in contact with an EEOC administrative judge. So we, you know, have our own system. We're about 90 judges for 2 million employees. And believe it or not, that actually works out fairly well. Contrary to what people think about federal employees, they're not super litigious, and we've handled that very well. But I do want to talk quickly about how the ADA Amendments Act of 2008 has affected my job with regard to disability cases. And I, of course, you know, I'm going to hit a few quick points about the act. We're not going to spend a lot of time. We could spend a lot of time going into the specifics of that. But obviously, in 2009, Congress enacted the ADAAA. And it certainly opened up, I believe, the act to groups of litigants who were not getting their opportunity, at least before us in the federal government. And, you know, again, I know we're talking about federal employees, but, you know, there is a correlation here. They were not getting the opportunity to fully adjudicate their claims. I'll give you an example. An individual, let's say, with diabetes, and he's an employee of a federal government agency. And he, you know, has difficulty getting into work on time because of medications, and he needs to take insulin at work, and he needs to eat at certain times during the day that doesn't fit in normally with his daily routine. And he wants an accommodation. He wants to resolve these issues. He's a good employee. He wants to continue working and fix these problems. Prior to the ADAAA, the agency's attorney looks at the case and says, well, is this person an individual with a disability under the Rehabilitation Act? Use the term Rehabilitation Act. We still use that in the federal government, the precursor of the ADA. It's basically the ADA at this point, but that's what we use. And the attorney for the agency looks at this individual and says, well, with his insulin and medication, he's not much different than the average person in society. Is there a real severe limitation of a major life activity? Can't really find it. So with his medications, he and many others cannot meet the standard, and in our forum, we were seeing many cases like that, where individuals who have a problem that need to be resolved, that problem never actually getting to the judge because the case goes out on summary judgment, because under the analysis that we had to do, that person could not meet the standard of a person with a disability under the Act, or at least in many cases. So now we have the ADAAA, and the employee can show that his impairment or disease impacts a bodily function. In the case of the person with diabetes, we're talking about the endocrine system. So he no longer does a substantial limitation mean a severe restriction, right? It means an impact. It impacts this system, and basically both the law, which was enacted in 2009, and now the regulation by the EEOC, which came out, I think, May of last year, we're directed, to lean in a direction of inclusion in that situation. So basically, we're no longer looking at, his medication before we let him in the door under the Act. Okay, we're no longer looking at mitigation, except that you may know there is one exception to that, and that is ordinary eyeglasses. Now, the regulation is clear, however, that ordinary eyeglasses are not to be confused with low vision devices that enhance vision. And also, even with ordinary eyeglasses, you still have the opportunity to do the analysis and find out, do those ordinary eyeglasses really put you outside of what a person with a disability is under the Act? So that's a good example, but I think the question is, or at least the important thing is, so what's the result? What am I seeing in the cases coming before me in the federal sector due to the ADAAA? I have to tell you, in some ways, I think the jury is still out on that, because the regulation was only a year ago. I haven't had a large amount of cases come in under the ADAAA, but when I do, I can tell you this, my work is less than it used to be. That initial analysis of deciding, is this person a person with a disability, is very simple. Congress has said, don't spend time on that. Go to the question at hand. The person needs an accommodation. What was the agency's response to the person's request? Was there interaction? Get right in there, get involved, and resolve the case, or make a finding, or don't. But let's get to the issue at hand, and I can tell you that's happening, and that's really for us a wonderful result of the ADAAA. I think I don't have the data here, and I don't know how I can get it, but I think I'm getting fewer cases from federal agencies. And I think that's a good thing in this case. And I'll tell you why. In our system, the case doesn't come directly to the EEOC when an employee at a federal agency files a complaint. The case, the employee must file the claim with the agency. And the agency then has the opportunity to try to resolve that case, then investigate that case. And after the investigation, the complainant, or we call them complainants, it's a plaintiff, it's an employee. The employee has the opportunity then to request a hearing before an EEOC administrative judge. But what I believe is happening, since agency lawyers have read the ADAAA and the regulations, I think they're saying, we used to file summary judgment motions on these, and that's not going to float. We need to sit down and take a look at our problem here. And it's a gut feeling, but I think that's happening. I think we're going to show over the next few years that at least at the hearing level, we're going to have fewer cases. My job has become more interesting based on the Act, because, as I said, I get to we EEOC administrative judges spend quite a bit of time picking and choosing cases that we think we can pull the litigants aside and say, you know, you're in a situation where we have a good employee in an agency that does good work, and litigation for a year and a half is really not going to serve you very well. Let's sit down and see if we can work this out. We spend a lot of time doing that. And this ADAAA gives us that option. So I am, you know, if we're talking about what's happening now in disability law with my cases, that's a breath of fresh air, and that's where we're the direction we're moving. I think I will stop at that. And
I'll back up your statistics.
Oh, thanks.
The federal court statistics, and not because of Iqbal and Twombly. I don't really think that has much to do with it. Fewer summary judgment motions since the amendments, and I think we're even going to get fewer if people read the EEOC regulations. Very few summary judgment motions being granted across the board for the defendants. And actually, approximately, the trial rate is under 5% if you take all, they'd come under the classification of civil rights litigation, the way the federal court nationwide, there's a 95% settlement rate, which is not inconsistent with most other cases. The trial rates are down in most parts of the country under 5%. But the summary judgment, even though we're getting more motions to dismiss early on, not unique to these cases because of Twombly and Iqbal, it's a change just like what you've described.
Yeah.
Fewer motions, very few being granted since those amendments, and the focus seems to always kind of end up on the reasonable accommodation issue oftentimes, it would seem.
Yeah.
But which I think is a good thing.
Yeah,
so,
very
sorry.
Good. No. Thank you very much, and, you know, I'll put that into my next article. Or we'll talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Well, now, Judge Frank, he did have a few minutes left, so though you took his, it was all right.
Well, yeah, I'm very sorry. I don't want to be stereotyped like a lot of the robitis. A lot of federal judges get that robitis affliction, you know.
Oh, I get it.
I don't think I'm one of those, but I do apologize.
I appreciate the comments. There is time for questions. As a matter of fact, there's considerable time for questions. These judges have done it in fairly good time. So those who have questions, if you will let it be known, Megan will bring you a microphone.
And Dr. Maurer, let me make an announcement for those who have questions. There are two stand-up microphones located in the center aisle, on either side of the center aisle, about three rows back from the podium. If you have a question, please make your way to one of the microphones and stand in line. If it is difficult for you to get to the microphone, raise your hand, and I will come to you with the portable microphone.
And I have one other adjuration here. That is this. Dr. Tenbrook taught a long time, and he said to his students, and he said to the meetings he conducted, tell me your name. I already know mine. So you don't need to ask me, tell me my name, because I know it. Just tell me yours, and then you get recognition that way. Are there questions?
Daniel Goldstein has a question.
Dan Goldstein. Get your mic, Dan, or if it's not on, turn it on. Will, have you got the mic on?
Usually I have trouble being heard.
We are recording this.
Okay. Is it now on?
No. Nope. Megan, give him one, you know. Yeah, just give him a mic.
Thank you. Judge Frank, when I was listening to you talk about the CLE program, I was stunned because I don't think that's been replicated anywhere else, and it desperately needs to have that happen. But as I understood it, it was CLE for the lawyers. And from what I can gather, disability job discrimination cases have only a lower... only prisoner cases have a lower success rate than... job discrimination disability cases, and I don't think it's because they're the next most frivolous. So I think there needs to be some kind of education of the judges. Certainly my unscientific sampling, which is biased by my limitations as an advocate, suggest to me that there are some judges in need of education about stereotypes. How do we get that done?
We've been invited to speak at a couple of the judicial conferences. We're doing the state judges in Minnesota after they heard we were doing it for the state. I got up because the microphone here doesn't seem to work. And so I know I entirely agree with you, and I don't mean to exclude that the judges are the enlightened ones. I think you've captured exactly right. That's why I will say to you that after a couple of these sessions, then this Interact Theater Group, I had one of my best friends, and I don't think he'd considered a violation of a confidence, Chief Judge Michael Davis in our district, come up to me because we were state judges years ago together, and he said, "I'm sorry. I knew you were involved in this disability," and he was the first African-American judge, and he said, "I thought I understood discrimination, racism. I don't. This is opening my eyes. We have to do something about this." So I think that will begin happening, but I couldn't agree with you more. I didn't mean to say the judges were the enlightened ones. We are not.
So. No, but I think if you decided you wanted to approach the administrative office of the courts, you'd find 50 or 60 people in this room who'd be happy to help you.
You may be hearing from us, and I can give you the contact information for our director, Tiffany Sanders, who kind of masterminds all this for us, too, because we've been doing employers as well. Medtronic has asked us in Minnesota to come and speak to them. I'll get you the information.
Thank you.
I saw another question in the
front. And who's seeking the floor?
Hi, this is Howard Rosen from the Bishop for the Deaf.
Howard Rosenblum, go ahead.
The judges. One second. It's great to see the three judges here. I want to ask all of you a question related to your respective area. I've noticed that state courts, even though under Title II of the ADA, they're supposed to provide equal access, most state courts throughout the country do not have a system to approach people who request for reasonable accommodation in the courtroom how to do that when they need an accommodation to go speak, or, you know, including the attorneys and the various parties involved.
It varies.
And a lot of courts do not have an approach with it. Like federal court.
I can give some perspective. Is the question
not yet
finished?
Not yet.
Okay.
One more thing. In federal court, there is no accommodation provision for federal courts at all, other than the rule for provisions of sign language interpreters. However, there's no other accommodation for any person with a disability in a federal court. What can we do to change that?
From a state perspective, Wisconsin, we put together a task force right away as soon as the ADA became promulgated, and now each county has an ADA coordinator. You know, it's a case-by-case thing, and sometimes it takes a longer time to get an accommodation than others, but things are occurring. When we build a new courthouse, they become ADA compliant. When there's an addition built to a courthouse, they become ADA compliant. We now have qualified ASL interpreters. We didn't have those when we started, but now it's a vibrant program. There are 30 programs in the state and the country now that have qualified ASL interpreter programs, but that means that there are 20 that don't. And of those 20, you probably know those 20. Some of them are pretty adamant against that. And for money reasons or whatever, I don't know. When it first became promulgated, I was invited to speak at judicial conferences all over the country. I spoke at about 40 of them. I think that was my count. And I was well received in maybe half of them. And the other half, for one reason or another, the judges were, I don't know how to put it, they were, they had their hands folded, and they just weren't interested in listening to what I have to say. So I think a lot of that has to do with the culture of the state. Frankly, as a state court judge from Wisconsin, I don't know how to reach out to those people in those other states. I won't name those states, but you probably know of them. But my advice is that somebody has to start the ball rolling in those states that aren't accommodating. Somebody has to be the force to start it. I just wish I had the answers to how to do it.
And I can just say in 1 minute or less on the feds, because what you say is correct. I'm proud to say in our two remodel jobs recently in Minnesota, every courtroom is ADA compliant with podiums that go up and down, ramps onto every location of the witness stand, or moving elevators. And all I'll say is this, what's being talked about nationally is equal, if the word equal justice under law means anything above the U.S. Supreme Court building, we are being told. The large groups of individuals with disabilities are telling us they've been forgotten, and if we want any trust in America, so it's at least you've got our attention, and I think you'll see some changes because you're exactly right. So.
Hi, my name is Paula Perlman. I'm from the Disability Rights Legal Center. I'm sorry to interrupt.
I'm
you
sorry.
Have a question.
That's okay.
He's got the true wisdom.
Can you hear me? Yeah, I think so. Just quickly, I just wanted to say in answer to that question, in our federal forum, it's the agency, the defendant in the case, who is responsible for providing any accommodation that we require in the courtroom. Our courtrooms, by the way, are usually not courtrooms. We're kind of like traveling judges, and we set up wherever we go, so we need to make sure we have what we need. We also sanction federal agencies who do not provide what we require. For instance, I usually require two American Sign Language interpreters in a room with a deaf witness or complainant.
And we do the same.
Yeah. Thanks.
Now, your name?
Paula Perlman.
Yes, ma'am.
From the Disability Rights Legal Center. So I have a couple comments. One, our office has sued state courts in L.A. County and San Bernardino County for not being physically accessible and programmatically accessible. But California really has a wonderful rule of court and even a judicial council approved form, a request for accommodation. And so it's really a model for Title II accommodations, and all the judges as a result of the litigation have been trained as well as the court clerks on disability accommodations. It's not a perfect system, but it's a really workable system. And quite frankly, I'm not patient. I really don't think we have to be supplicants to the judiciary. You know, it's our courts. They're for us. And we have First Amendment access rights to courts that I think absolutely must be enforced. And with respect to the federal courts, I was the co-chair of the lawyer representatives for the Central District for the Ninth Circuit Judicial Conference. And we did our federal, we sued the state court in federal court, right? And it was interesting because the federal court judge in that case had never, it was like, oh, you're right, what do we do about accommodations? You know, like, what are we supposed to do? And I just trained all the courtroom deputies in the Central District about disability accommodations. And I think under Tennessee v. Lane, and I think under the First Amendment, we have rights that have yet to be assertive with the federal court. And I will tell you that we have a Ninth Circuit amicus brief pending in an accommodation court case because the client asked for an accommodation at the district court level and they had no idea what to do. And so they published the accommodation, then they they put it up on PACER, then they took it off of PACER. They assigned an attorney to develop an accommodation policy. This is ripe for activism and advocacy. But I think that the first time I met a judge at not in a courtroom, but in a social setting at the Central District Conference, his first comment to me, "Hi, I'm Paula Perlman. Nice to meet you. I'm from the Disability Rights Legal Center. Why do you people file those cases against mom-pa stores? Why do you file those kinds of cases?" And it was, you know, talk about the amount of education that still needs to occur within the judiciary. So I applaud your efforts.
It may be more important now than ever to do this because there's cost containment memos flying all over the United States about cutting costs, and at least I can see the federal court. So
right.
It's probably as important as it's ever been to do this activism, frankly, and keep it out there.
I wrote a letter to the GSA and copied the district court clerk, who's my ally. She's like, "Paula, don't you think there's some accessibility problems at our courthouse that you should write a letter to me about?" It's like, "Yes, I do. I think there are." And so I think the courts are looking for allies as well. So thank you.
Did she invite you to sue her?
She didn't invite me to sue her, but she did invite me to meet with her.
Uh-huh. Other questions? Gentlemen, do you want to answer that? You want to talk about this before we get the next question? Judges? One of you said, yes, I agree. Other commentary? We'll go to the next question then.
Hi, this is Larry Paradis from Disability Rights Advocates. Following up on the last comment, there's quite a lot of controversy out there now about the lawsuits against the small businesses, including a front page story on the New York Times this week. Could you share with us the view from within the bench, both state and federal, on how you see these ADA access cases and whether you think there's a problem or this is just the results of social progress over 20 years since the ADA? Or is it something we really need to be worried about? Are we losing the hearts and minds of the public for ADA cases?
Gentlemen?
I'll repeat something that was said earlier by one of the audience members, that I think most of the cases that we're seeing have merit. I don't think we're losing the hearts and minds of people. I actually think it's the social progression of things, and it's about time that these things are happening. I think lots of times it's all about the money, and I don't want to speak in platitudes, but I think this equal justice, I think that a lot of disability advocates will not be silent any longer, and I think the time is right with the anniversary and these amendments we've talked about, and most cases I see have significant merit, unlike a number of the other cases that we see, and that's probably why they are settling with significant injunctive relief and accessibility issues. But I don't know if other people in the audience or my fellow panelists will think I'm a bit naive about that, but I think people should keep doing what they're doing. As I can tell you candidly, that there's no, in my district, there's no discussions behind the doors in a derogatory way about these cases. It's quite the contrary, in my view. But I did read the New York Times article.
Yes,
but,
Judge Brown. I'm going to use the podium because this podium is in the way.
I'm not hiding back.
You know, I've often wondered why. I know that there's some empirical data out there about using the state courts for ADA-type matters, but I've often wondered why litigants don't use the state courts more than they do, why they run to the federal courts. The federal courts, from anecdotally, I understand that it takes them a long time to get around to it, if they get around to it at all. Whereas the state courts, you get on fairly easy. Now, I know that there are some state courts that are some states that where they're not very receptive to disability rights, I agree with Paula, it's time to get on their case. But there are other states that I think would be amenable to these suits, where the judges understand, they've had the training, they understand disability law, they understand what's at stake, and they want to be accommodating. and we don't get this. We don't get as many. I don't know the reason for it.
Judge Polito, you got a comment?
I think I'm going to hold off on that. I mean, that's a political question, and as I just said to Judge Frank, I'm not quite in the same position as our, the two esteemed judges here. I'm part of the EEOC, and I don't want to speak for the EEOC today, or if I do, at least on matters that might involve politics. But my answer would be
political.
And I think I'm just not going to
turn the camera off for a minute.
Thank you.
Maybe during a break you can tell us.
Other questions?
My name is Robert Borelli. I'm a second-year law student at Syracuse University College of Law. I have a question for the judges about the ADA Amendments Act. I would like to know, in your personal experience, have complainants attempted to apply the act retroactively? And if you have any feelings on whether the act could or should be applied retroactively?
Well, it's not applied retroactively in my forum, and I don't believe anywhere. But and I haven't had any situations where people made attempts to bootstrap cases in. It is, you know, certainly unfortunate for some litigants, and does create, for somebody like me who's dealing actually with, you know, cases under both laws right now, it's a little, you feel a little schizophrenic at times. But that's. It is what it is, I think.
I would have the same answer, and it does create kind of a, it can create a fiction, but I don't know, I haven't been asked, I don't know of a case where that has occurred, so.
Judge Brown, what about in your court?
We haven't had that issue come up. I guess maybe that's just an add-on to what I just said. We're not getting as many disability-related cases in our state courts, and I think that's that question is also reflective of that answer.
Other questions?
As a law student walks away, I would just say to him, we have a disability law society in one of the four law schools in the Twin Cities, and they are rocking and rolling. They're helping us in a lot of these CLEs, by the way. They're thanks to the deans of law school.
Now, I just want to tell you, Judge Frank, if you want the National Federation of the Blind to participate, we would be willing, and I suspect that Howard there from the National Association for the Deaf would, and I imagine there's some others.
All right.
So let us know.
We will.
Other questions?
Patty Chang, Illinois. More a comment than anything. I occasionally represent Chicago police officers in 1983 actions, so I use PACER. I am concerned that the IT people who are dealing with PACER are calling me with their questions about how to use it with JAWS. I am not normally I'm in state court. I'm not even an expert user of PACER. So the fact that I have become a resource, I don't mind being a resource, but it's a little telling as to how much training the IT people are getting with regard to PACER and accessibility. Thank you.
Scott LaBarre over there can tell you whether or not the electronic system in the court, federal courts, is working, as he does it all the time. Pardon me, judges. Go ahead.
No, I just said I'll pass the word for sure. So,
it's sort of working. Scott LaBarre says it's sort of working. Other questions or comments?
My name is Ava Argamonte, and I'm a third-year law student.
Go ahead.
A lot of the questions have touched upon cost and the fact that, especially in a poor economy, there's not a lot of social sentiment in favor of accommodations because of the cost they impose, especially when we talk about small businesses. And I was wondering, when you talk about sort of a cost-benefit analysis, there is a benefit component, and that's not often brought up, and I'm wondering how effective is it for a lawyer or an advocate to bring up in court that a disability accommodation can in fact have a third-party benefit, or does that undercut the notion of accommodations specifically for individuals with disabilities?
I would, some people might suggest it would undercut it. I wouldn't be one of those. I would suggest doing exactly that. And it does come up oftentimes in settlement discussions, like in our district, the magistrate judges play a big part in settlement, and that's exactly where it comes up. But there is a cost-benefit analysis that I think more and more people are making, and I don't see the downside to it, frankly. I really don't. So,
I'm going to, at the risk of repeating what I already said earlier, I think cost comes up just about on every occasion. It isn't that they don't understand the need, it's that they just don't want to pay because it costs money. So it's important, I think, to talk about cost benefit. It's important to talk about rights, first of all, just Title II, but it's also important to talk about how most accommodations can be obtained with at low cost. And a lot of the judges don't understand that. And a lot of the IT people don't understand that. But if you can get people together and say, look, this is what we need. We need a Kurzweil 3000, and this is what we can get. We can help you obtain it. We'll call the people for you, and you know we'll do this. You pay for it, and we'll be fine. And you know, I think a lot of times that works.
Dan Goldstein refers to the litigation that he does for us often as Eat Your Spinach litigation. And he does because he says the spinach is good for you, and if you eat it, you'll be better off. And if you do the accommodations that we request, you will get another marketplace, and furthermore, you will be able to serve your current marketplace better than you have been able to in the past. And he sort of it's a very homespun way of referring to his litigation as Eat Your Spinach legislation or litigation. But that has to do with the cost-benefit analysis. If you incorporate the people in the community who have been cut out of the community, after a while you'll get more productivity. So I think it's a great idea to bring it up. I bring it up, you know, every day almost. So, and I encourage people to believe in it, and if they don't believe in it, then I tell them that maybe we can find a way to require them to believe in it. So, we're coming to the end of this presentation. Judges, I appreciate your presentations. I appreciate your point of view. We have some...
is it possible to ask one more question?
Oh, another question. One more. Well, we'll take one more.
Thank you. And it just makes me think what you just said. Perhaps you could call it Popeye lawsuits. Anyway, my name is Sylvia Yee. I'm with Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. I had a question relating to training and the training of courts and judges. And it relates to a number of the things that were brought up. And I often training comes best from a specific individual with specific disabilities who can talk very personally about what is needed. But the most efficient way to do a training is to be talking about cross-disability and the broad range of accommodations that's needed, the whole process that is needed regardless of the specific disability. We're working a little bit with an individual right now with multiple chemical sensitivity who is involved in a landlord-tenant dispute. And so there are real issues about her ability to function in a courtroom with so many scents and products in the air. And some potentially expensive solutions, because we're talking about video conferencing or not being in the courtroom or in front of the jury at all. So the farther you get from something that's broadly recognized as a disability and accommodations that are widely known, the greater the resistance sometimes. And I'm wondering how to best overcome something like that when you're talking about broad trainings.
Judges? Judge Brown.
Yeah, I've got a couple of comments. First of all, something that probably won't answer your question, but it's important that I say it anyway. When you have these plenaries, these sessions with judges, and you make it voluntary. So a judge can go to one session or can go to another session. The only people who are going to go to the disability section are those who are amenable to granting accommodations anyway. Those who don't give a darn aren't going to be there. And you see this time and time again. So my advice is make it a plenary session where attendance is mandatory, because that's the only way that the judges who are reluctant to learn are going to learn. The second thing is more geared to what you have to say. As judges wonder all the time, we have this question, just how far does our obligation extend? And most judges say, it ends outside my courtroom door. Anything that happens outside the courtroom door, I'm not responsible. Some judges say, no, we'll go farther. It ends at the courthouse steps. Anything beyond the courthouse steps, we're not responsible for. And in your situation, your particular situation, where we're looking for teleconferencing, I think it's important to go to the judge and say, this is an exception. This is the problem. This is why we need this accommodation that will go beyond the courthouse steps. And I think that's the way to pitch it to that judge.
I would just say very, very briefly, and one most of us now have, but that's kind of not the preferred choice by most lawyers, if there is, they'd rather have their client there in front of the jury. In fact, when I was prosecuting cases, I always put the children and the people with disabilities on the witness stand. I didn't want the video. I wanted them in the courtroom, and they always did fabulous during trials. But if we could get by some of the discomfort. But assuming, because we all have video conferencing, my advice to you, because that's kind of a second alternative, is to get it in front of the court so the judge can't claim ignorance to the problem, whether it's early on or at a pretrial conference if the case is going on. Obviously, the proactive education so it is a better piece at a plenary session, as the judge has said, but if it's in a case-specific issue, get the issue in front of the judge and make him or her decide something on the record. So it's there, because memories fade, people forget. And that's, I can't tell you the number of people have asked me for a transcript where during jury selection, where the blind juror was picked for my trial, because the judges want to know how I handle it. Get something on the record is what I say. The proactive educational piece is the preferred one, because most judges, I'm sad to say, maybe like a lot of society, it's not on their wavelength, or just like not allowing somebody to bring in, depending on the diabetic condition, this nonsense that judges won't let snacks and juice and other things come in for medical reasons for lawyers or clients and others or jurors. That's a similar thing. If we're aware of it, maybe we can remedy the problem. So,
can I ask the questioner a quick question? Maybe this is open to everyone, do you interact with EEOC regarding training at all? Do people here do training in conjunction with EEOC? Anybody? Not maybe one in the back.